Thank you for joining us today for a podcast on irritable bowel syndrome. My name is Tony Hazel. I'm a GP in North London and an e-learning fellow for the RCGP. I'm joined by Dr. Kevin Barrett, who is a GP in Hertfordshire and chair of the Primary Care Society for Gastroenterology. Thank you for joining us, Kevin.
Thank you, Tony.
IBS has been described as a medical condition in itself, but also as more of an umbrella diagnosis for a variety of other conditions, things like lactose intolerance, non-celiac, gluten sensitivity, and bile salt malabsorption. How do you see the diagnosis of IBS?
IBS is one of those really interesting conditions. As you said, it can be an umbrella diagnosis that covers a whole range of other conditions, and a lot of research is going on at the moment. IBS can be diagnosed in primary care in the vast majority of cases. You don't necessarily need to go and see a gastroenterologist or have an endoscopy to get the diagnosis done for most people. It's currently a diagnosis of exclusion, but you don't need to exclude absolutely everything before you can be confident in giving a patient a provisional diagnosis of IBS. Going back to basics is really important. So history and examination, looking out for red flag symptoms, just because the symptoms can overlap with those of serious conditions, such as colorectal cancer and inflammatory bowel disease. Things like weight loss, they're important to ask about, because that's uncommon in IBS unless there's been dramatic dietary restriction. And IBS rarely causes rectal bleeding. And the other key thing that's also worth asking about is about nighttime waking, because that rarely happens with IBS. And that's and if you ask a patient about that, then that kind of points you to more of a physical rather than a functional diagnosis. Again, things like colorectal cancer or inflammatory bowel disease. For me, I think those are three key symptoms that are worth asking about.
Once you've obviously taken a thorough history and, as you said, documented your positive and negative findings, what would you be looking for when you examine the patient?
But it's really important, wherever possible and appropriate, to do a physical examination of the abdomen, and again a rectal examination. That's important as well. Next step is basic blood tests. Again, we need to think about anemia, inflammation, thyroid disorders. Usually hypothyroidism, but hyperthyroidism can certainly cause IBS type symptoms sometimes. And celiac disease, that's the other key investigation, the key blood test. That's what is worth doing as your first step in primary care. When you do a celiac test, it's worth remembering that this is a test for the antibodies that are produced as the allergic reaction as well. So patients have to have been eating gluten-free containing food for at least once a day for 6 weeks before the test is done. And sometimes we see negative tests coming back, but the patient's already excluded pretty much all gluten from their diet. And you can't say that's a negative test unless they've been eating gluten. Once you've done that and you've ruled out anemia, inflammation and celiac disease, then fecal calprotectin is actually the next test that's worth doing. And this is the protein that's released in the presence of inflammation in the bowel, and that can pick up inflammation that doesn't necessarily show on a blood test. So those are the tests that are worth doing in that order. And then provided all the tests are negative and the patient clearly doesn't have any red flag symptoms, then you can be fairly confident in giving them a provisional diagnosis of IBS and then starting appropriate advice and treatment.
Thank you. That's really, really useful to know where the different tests all fit in. So I sometimes find that this point can be a bit tricky. Hopefully I've sort of explained to the patient before I start that we're not doing any tests for IBS. We're doing tests to rule out other things. But I think some patients feel that giving a diagnosis of IBS is slightly fobbing them off. It's a kind of, you don't know what it is, so you're calling it IBS. How would you go about explaining a diagnosis of IBS to a patient?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think lots of people used to think that IBS is just to do with stress and it's all in the mind. However, actually, there's a lot more research and interest into IBS at the moment. And we know that there is that big link between the gut and the brain. And again, IBS isn't one single condition, because it's not the same in every patient. So different patients get different sets of symptoms. Some patients get more of a diarrhea predominant set of symptoms, some get constipation, and some get a mixture too. So current thinking involves a number of different things. There may be a hypersensitivity of the visceral pain receptors in the bowel, and these can fire at lower thresholds in patients with IBS, and therefore if you exclude the foods that cause the swelling and fluid retention that causes the bowel to expand, lots of patients get relief by that. So the exclusion diets can definitely be important. There's also evidence that there's a miscommunication that happens in the neurological connections between the gut and the brain. And that's where the gut-brain hypothesis or the gut-brain dysfunction terms come from too. And that's why if you work on the way, on the traditional things that help the brain, they can also help the nerves and the plexus and the neurological parts of the gut. So things like cognitive behavioral therapy, hypnotherapy, and even the antidepressant medications, they can actually help work on the way the gut works. So IBS, again, it's one of those things, I think there's no, again, there's an overlap in symptoms between what's normal and what's causing the patient impairment and affecting their livelihoods. And IBS certainly comes and goes. All of us, I think, you know, listen to this podcast, have experienced IBS type symptoms at some point with increased bowel motions and abdominal pain and bloating. And they're usually triggered off by stress. So, you know, doing exams or even before recording a podcast.
Definitely. So you mentioned that inflammatory bowel disease and colorectal cancer would be things that you might be looking to exclude. Are there other differential diagnoses that are reasonably high up in your head when someone presents with possible IBS?
Yeah, absolutely. Lower gastrointestinal symptoms are really problematic, and a lot of it is searching for that needle in the haystack. IBS is pretty common. Lots of people get it, but symptoms can certainly overlap with others. And we hear stories about patients who've had misdiagnosis of all sorts of things. So colorectal cancer, ovarian cancer, celiac disease, inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's colitis, endometriosis, pelvic inflammatory disease, and a whole host of other ones as well. But I think the key thing is when a patient comes to you with that history of lower abdominal pain, bloating, and a change in bowel habit for at least 6 months or more, those are the key factors. I think, you know, IBS is probably going to be top of your list, but it's really important not to miss those other diagnoses as well.
Yeah, it's very difficult. None of us want to end up on the front of the newspaper having told someone they had IBS and they turn out to have something else. So once you've made a diagnosis and you're happy that it's a secure one and that there's nothing else going on, we don't normally refer these patients to secondary care. We usually manage them ourselves. Can you tell me a bit about what treatments I might be able to offer as a GP?
Yeah, absolutely. NICE CG61 gives us a big list of things that we can try in primary care. And it can seem a bit overwhelming to patients and to us as well. But the mainstay, actually, which we often forget about, is actually lifestyle advice. You know, it's quite easy to reach the prescription pad straight away. But for IBS, lifestyle is a key factor. And again, it's convincing the patient, getting on board, that you're not just flopping them off with telling them to go and be more healthy. Actually, there is strong evidence that these can make a big difference in the vast majority of patients. Relaxation, regular physical exercise, again, you know, easy to say and harder to do in real life when you've got, you know, busy lifestyles and patients zipping all over the place as well. And then some dietary advice is important too. And again, going back to basics. So, you know, regular whole food meals, relaxed when you're eating rather than rushing around with having fast food on the go. That can certainly make a big difference. Fibre in the diet is important to adjust. Usually reducing the fibre, that's often the first way to go. Although occasionally some patients get benefit from having a slight increase in fibre in the diet. And then looking at other things such as artificial sweeteners. And NICE is quite clear that things like sorbitol, often found in chewing gum, for example, is best avoided. And then you can start adding in other things to that. So oats, linseed oil, flaxseed oil, and they can be useful for some patients with bloating. So it's quite tricky to do that in a 10-minute consultation. And often you need to kind of get the patient back a couple of times or share some information with them, give them things to read, put them in touch with other organisations. And if you're very lucky, then involve a dietitian. I know some areas have got more dietitians than others, but they can certainly be very useful for this too. But I guess once you've kind of gone through that part and you've tried the dietary advice, the next stage is to suggest some things that they can purchase themselves. So over-the-counter antispasmodics, such as hyoscin, sort of peppermint oil capsules, they can be beneficial and can help with some of the pain. Although actually occasionally by relaxing the bowel a bit, they can make the constipation a bit worse. So you have to be a little bit careful about the patient to get the constipation side of things too. And if you get diarrhea, then things like loperamide is safe for long-term or intermittent use to kind of adjust to that to make the stools a little bit more solid and a bit more formed and to help control some of the urgency that some patients get with it as well. And then I guess the next stage really is to think about actually getting a prescription pad out. And the old-fashioned tricyclic antidepressants, amitriptyline, those sorts of medications, they can certainly help that gut-brain dysfunction as well. Some people tolerate those very well. Some don't like side effects they get. Again, can get constipation, sometimes get weight gain, particularly with the bigger doses. Then you can use an SSRI. Although again, it can be quite harder, a little bit harder to convince the patients to take that for their bowel when they're so widely known for use in mental health disorders. So again, it's getting the patient on board and persuading them and that actually is the right route for them to go down with it as well. And then laxatives, again, we still use laxatives in patients that get the constipation predominant IBS. Lactulose is one that probably should be avoided for a whole host of reasons, not just for the dental problems it can cause, but actually because it can cause bloating in a way that food like FODMAPs can cause. And then you've got some new medications like linaclotide that can be used in patients who've got treatment-resistant constipation. But actually, local prescribing guidance can be a little bit tricky. That is quite a new drug, and I don't think a lot of areas have kind of got their prescribing guidance sorted out around that yet. So, but that's a possibility for some patients too. So, there's a whole range of different things we can do as our first line. It's interesting.
Yeah, so there's quite a lot, and we can empower our patients to do things for themselves as well as things we can prescribe. So you talked about diet and possibly involving a dietitian, and I have sometimes had patients come in and ask me about the FODMAP diet as a treatment for IBS, but I've generally been quite hesitant because it sounds quite restrictive and possibly something that should involve a dietitian rather than patient doing on their own. Can you tell us a bit more about the FODMAP diet?
Yeah, the FODMAP diet's interesting. It's touched upon briefly in NICE. It's useful because it's a multi-food exclusion diet. Lots of patients with IBS, they know exactly which foods trigger off their symptoms, and then they naturally avoid those or can identify which ones they are and manage their life around it as well. When it's unclear actually which are their trigger foods, then the low FODMAP diet can be interesting. Generally best done under the guidance of somebody who's trained in its use, and that usually means a dietitian. And again, if you have the luxury of dietitians locally, they're absolutely fantastic for doing this. They don't necessarily have to be seen face to face, and they've got busy patients. They do remote work, they do group things, they do online sessions as well. So there's a whole different way you can get that dietary advice into people as well. The key of the FODMAP diet, so the FODMAPs stand for fermentable oligo, di, mono, and monosaccharides and polyols. I'd always have to think about that before I'd say it. And there's different food groups within that. If a patient excludes all of those foods from their diet long term, they can run into problems with malabsorption. So they need to be really, really careful about just telling people to go off and exclude FODMAP diets, because there are lists of those on the internet. It's not meant to be a long-term thing. You're meant to do the removal, reintroduction, and then the personalization. So removing those foods, there are foods that stay in the gut. They don't necessarily get absorbed very well. They get fermented by the microbiome that's in there as well. They attract fluids and cause bloating. And again, if any of us eat enough of these foods, we will all get the IBS type symptoms. So if we gorge ourselves on pizza and milk and that's all we get, then actually our guts would swell and expand. We would start to get some of those symptoms. But as we talked about before, the patients with IBS, they have a lower threshold for those pain receptors being triggered off by it as well. Because the FODMAPs include dairy and wheat, patients often come to us saying, I can't tolerate wheat. Have I got celiac disease? So you do a celiac test and it comes back negative. This may be non-celiac gluten sensitivity. This is the only food group they can't tolerate. But it might also come under the umbrella of IBS. But actually, because wheat's a FODMAP, then it is fair enough to kind of think about that excluding from the diet as well. So basically, you send off the dietitian. The dietitian gives them advice. They exclude all those things for a minimum of 2 weeks, often 4 to 6 weeks. And then you start reintroducing things again. And the reintroduction bit is the key phase of this rather than exclusion part, because you have to build up the tolerance in the gut again. And then the dietitians are really helpful about kind of introducing small amounts of food in a staged way according to the symptoms the patient's getting. And the aim is to kind of rebuild that tolerance. And lots of patients can actually then you know, really tolerate those foods. And occasionally we've got to go around the loop a couple, you know, two or three times until we find the right way of doing it. But again, it's difficult because you need to overcome some of that fear that patients have that if they eat a certain food, they're going to get the symptoms and they're going to have to dash off the toilet or, you know, lie awake with bloating and pain. And so overcoming that's quite tricky. And then I guess you get to that final stage of personalization where you've done all sorts of things, you've reintroduced things, but there were still some foods that just set off the symptoms no matter what. And those are the foods that you end up actually saying to the patient, you know, yeah, those are the ones that cause the problems. You're best avoiding those. But if you know, it's not a problem to eat them, but if you do eat them, your symptoms will come back again. And I think trying to do that in primary care without that level of nutrition training is quite tricky to do. So I think the dietitian has to be involved with those discussions.
Yeah, I'd completely agree with that. It's certainly way beyond my skills, and I can completely see how people might get stuck in the bit where they've taken things out and their symptoms have gone away and be reluctant to move forwards. So one thing that patients always ask us about is alternative therapies, and I find it very difficult because I often don't know very much about them. I don't know how much they've been tested and so on. Are there any alternative or herbal therapies that we can safely recommend and say that should be reasonably safe and might help the patient's symptoms?
Yeah, we often hear from patients that they've got friends or relatives that have tried a certain diet or a certain alternative therapy and it's worked wonders for them, and that may well be true. NICE is quite clear, it's evidence-based. It says actually we shouldn't recommend things like acupuncture, reflexology or aloe vera. So they're not in our, you know, there's no medical evidence for them. Some patients do still gain benefit from it, but that's not something we should be, you know, particularly recommending to all our patients. NICE does talk about probiotics, and probiotics and microbiome are a key part of IBS. And there's not a lot written in IBS about this. It's just mentioned quite briefly. Probiotics, there's a lot of research going into probiotics by some of the dietitians looking at dietary therapy for a broad range of IBS conditions and symptoms. But again, there's still no clear evidence about which ones we should recommend to our patients. And that's why NICE says, try it for 4 weeks. So give it a decent go. You're not going to get a response straight away. And if it works, then you can carry on with it. If it hasn't made any difference after 4 weeks, then you can kind of rule that one out. The problem is there are so many on the market and so many around, it's very, very hard at the moment to know which ones, and hopefully we'll get some clearer guidance in the near future. There's lots written about fermented foods. And if you go onto Instagram and social media, you'll see lots of people with talking about the prebiotics and colourful foods and fermented foods and a whole range of different things too. And absolutely, that's something we should be recommending anyway, because the health benefits for our patients kind of exceed those for just the IBS group as well. Sauerkraut, kefir, kombucha, there's been research that's gone into those. And actually, they can be more effective than probiotics in some cases. So having a good colourful plate, lots of fibre in your diet, lots of vegetables, generally that can make a difference, bearing in mind some of them are FODMAPs as well. So that's always the trade-off between those two things too. But fermented foods, absolutely, definitely worth trying.
That's really useful because I think it gives people sometimes a bit of ownership of their condition if they can be told to go off and try something, see if it helps and work some aspects of it out for themselves. So most people with IBS we're going to be treating in general practice, but obviously there will be some patients that we need to refer. What sort of things tend to hit your referral threshold for a patient that you've been managing for IBS in primary care?
Yeah, there are. I think we must be careful not to overwhelm secondary care with referrals of things that they don't necessarily need to see. Obviously, the red flag and the two-week wait referrals, they absolutely have to go to secondary care. Any patient who's got a complicated history with multiple medical conditions, they should probably be seen in secondary care as well. But most of the straightforward ones we can manage quite happily in primary care with the aid of dietitians and such like. There's also a group of patients who try a huge range of different things. They might try some medication, they'll try dietary changes, they'll try some probiotics, and nothing makes a difference. And they've still got their ongoing symptoms, and you know, they keep coming back to you, and those when you think, well, actually, hang on a minute, what else might be going on? And there are some conditions that underlie things where investigations you do to reach the point of a fairly strong diagnosis of IBS don't pick up. There are a couple of conditions, things like microscopic colitis, and that typically affects patients in their 50s who get persistent watery diarrhea that just keeps going on and on. And there's another one called bile acid malabsorption. And again, that tends to give you urgency and watery diarrhea, and occasionally can give incontinence, and you can still get that with microscopic colitis as well. The problem with those is that there aren't any tests we can do in primary care. There are investigations that need to be done in secondary care. So, for example, colonoscopies with biopsies to actually have a look for microscopic colitis, those sorts of things too. And again, the other thing is always be wary about patients who were given a diagnosis of IBS years ago and they come back and say, well, actually, the symptoms are similar but a bit different, because those are ones we need to be wary of, because we mustn't assume that every bowel symptom that a patient with IBS has is to do with their IBS. If it's the same symptoms that are triggered off by the same foods and affect them in the same way, it probably is. But if those alarm bells are ringing and you think, actually, it's a little bit different, or the patient doesn't look quite right, or the story, you know, doesn't sound very similar to what they had before, or if they develop new red flag symptoms, then we have to think about, you know, have they developed something else? And we do hear stories about patients with colorectal cancer and Crohn's and colitis, those sorts of conditions, kind of having their diagnosis delayed because everyone assumes that it's down to pre-existing IBS. So those just my only cautions really about not referring patients. I think there's definitely a group that do need to be referred.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd agree. And particularly as patients get older and some of the other conditions like colorectal cancer become more common. So obviously, if I have any patient with IBS, I'm going to be signposting them to you at the Primary Care Society for Gastroenterology. Are there any other organisations that can support patients and or give advice to GPs?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the main one for this is the IBS Network. I think they're a great organisation. They've got lots of information on their website, and they provide a huge amount of support to patients. For me, that's probably the main one I've put in contact with. There are other, there are more local groups that people can help that can help patients and support it. But I think the IBS Network is the best one. They offer peer-reviewed support that is based on scientific evidence as well. Again, there's lots and lots of things written out that anyone can call themselves a nutrition expert and post whatever they want to on social media. There's also another organisation that PCSG have worked with called The Gut Stuff, and they're twins that set this up, and they're interested in gut health because even though they're identical twins, they have a huge difference in their own microbiome, and they've been used for research projects internationally. But they actually provide peer-reviewed and scientifically appropriate information as well. So either of those, I think, would certainly point patients towards.
That's great. Thank you very much. So I think we've covered pretty much everything from when the patient walks through the door to when we see them, we treat them, when we might want to refer, and how we can support them. Have you got any final thoughts that you'd like to share?
Yeah, IBS is one of the diseases that's common, but it can also mimic many others. In itself, it can be life-altering, but we can manage it usually very effectively with a combination of empowerment, self-help, and lifestyle modification. Medication has a place, but again, this shouldn't be the first step. So lifestyle, exercise, diet, those are the key points, I think, about IBS.
That's true about so many things that we see in general practice. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening to this podcast about IBS. I'm Tony Hazel, e-learning fellow at the RCGP, and I've been joined by Kevin Barrett, chair of the Primary Care Society for Gastroenterology. Thank you very much.